Welcome to the SPS Digital Learning Hour, brought to you by the Digital Learning and Assessment Department. We're coming to you today from a conference room in Central Office, bringing you the latest news in Springfield Public Schools in regards to technology, along with inspiring interviews from teachers who are using technology in the classroom. I'm your host, Mike Thomas, the Bearded Tech Ed Guy. You can find me out on all the socials at Bearded Tech Ed, my website, beardedtechedguy.com, and of course, the WeLearn page on MySPS. Before we get to today's interviews, I just want to highlight just a couple of things inside of MySPS and some news and updates for you. The latest blog post is out, and it's all about how to use Reading Progress in the classroom. Reading Progress is one of these amazing tools from Microsoft. We've got all the instructions right there for you to use, especially if you are an elementary teacher or an EL teacher looking to help your students. Keep an eye out for some upcoming blogs as they get posted about every other week right now. We're going to be talking about ChatGPT, video in the classroom, and audio in the classroom. And so I hope you check those out because there's a lot of great useful information in all of them. The other thing I'm going to highlight today is the 23 tools for 2023. If you go out to the Schoology resources page, there's going to be a little highlight video going up in the next day or so, talking about what the 23 tools are and how you can be a participant in it. We've already started, and there's already some people out on this leaderboard as we speak. So I encourage you to go out there and take a look, try out some of these tools, get some badges, add it to your seeds. It's fantastic time, and you're getting credit for the things you are already doing in the classroom. And who doesn't like getting credit? For today's interview of the week, I met with Matt Flood, who's one of our newest colleagues here on the DLA team. Some of you may have interacted with him during some trainings that he's already done this year. Maybe you are partaking in some of the things that he is working on right now. I'm excited to share this interview with you, and I'm hoping that you get a lot out of it. Matt's got a great history and one that is unique to our department. Take a listen.
My name is Matt Flood. I have been working in education in one form or another, I guess, since I graduated college. That's about 10 years now. And then I am currently a senior digital learning analyst at Springfield Public Schools. At some point in those 10 years, I taught ninth grade English for about 6.5 years in New York City.
So 6.5 years of ninth grade English. So what kind of technology did you use? Because every state is different, every city is different, and I imagine there's a lot of resources that were available to you. So what did you use?
Yeah, so when I first started, I think this is probably true of a lot of new teachers, I wasn't using a lot, right? I would sort of just put up a PowerPoint, and then occasionally I would sort of roll out one of those Chromebook carts. But one of the issues was often the Chromebooks or laptops, whatever it was, half of them would be broken, they never would be plugged in, and so it would always be a little bit of a challenge to actually like incorporate any of that technology in my classroom, in my teaching. Which is actually, I was working in a small school, about 400 students, and so not a lot of teachers, and we were also relatively new, so we were still figuring a lot of things out. And one of the things, sort of because the technology was pretty bad at that point when I first started teaching, I started to play more and more of a role in purchasing, getting, acquiring, and implementing technology sort of at the school level. So I sort of helped get a whole bunch of new Chromebooks for the school and deploy those in new carts that actually had 30, 32 functioning Chromebooks. And so once we sort of had a little bit more of an infrastructure in terms of the technology, I started to use it much more in my classroom. And I would do things like, and some of this I was doing before the pandemic, and then obviously the pandemic heightened a lot of it, but a lot more sort of interactive presentations. I was using Pear Deck at the time, which is very similar to Nearpod. I would do projects using Newzella and Soundtrap, which is a podcasting platform. So I was really, especially in the, as I started incorporating it more and more, I was taking the units I was already doing and kind of layering new technology on top of it.
Awesome. So here in Springfield, we are HP, Dell, regular laptops. What are some of the benefits that, because you were using Chromebooks, that you saw with them?
Yeah, so I think it didn't have the, I was also in some ways the person kind of managing all of the Chromebooks, sort of like the admin for them. And I would say it did make my life much easier on that end, because I didn't have to worry about students downloading things or making sure they were wiped each time. You don't really have to re-image. So there were some benefits on kind of that tech ops side. I would say the unification with the Google account, too, is super helpful. Students would just log into the Chromebook and have all their materials there. It would sync right up with their Drive, which is similar to how Microsoft has OneDrive now. And I would say just one of the biggest impacts for a school, especially a school who's maybe worried about budgeting or anything like that, they are pretty cheap. And also, you can get pretty like hardy ones. You know, students would try and fail in all the ways they can to either mess up the Chromebooks, you know, not always on purpose, of course, but usually they'd hold up and last a pretty long time.
That's really interesting to hear with the Chromebooks and just how you were using them and connecting them to the Google Suites. Now, did you have a learning management system that you were using, or were you using Google Classroom?
We were mostly using Google Classroom, largely because we already had the G Suite for Education, and so Google Classroom was built in. Some teachers, including myself, were using it before school shutdown or the pandemic. But then once we were all teaching remotely, we moved every teacher to using Google Classroom. That was sort of the expectation. And then that continued after we came back to in-person learning.
Awesome. So one of the things you mentioned a little bit ago was that when you first started using technology, you were using PowerPoints. Now, was your laptop a Chromebook, and did the Microsoft Suite work on there, or were you using I believe it's called Slides in Google, like the equivalent?
Yes, I was using Google Slides. I think I'm using PowerPoint. It's like the, you know, sort of the Kleenex term for any digital slideshow. Yeah, I would use Google Slides, which is pretty much the same function. I think the thing that I appreciated about them when I was first using them is they had a similar, Microsoft now has a design feature in PowerPoint that will essentially create the slide for you once you put the content in. And Google Slides had that. So as a new teacher, you know, staying up late, scrambling to get my presentations ready for the next day, that was super helpful because I just put what I needed in there and hit I think it's like an explore button or something like that in Google, and it creates a nicer design. So I just didn't have to worry about that aspect of it.
Yeah, I love the design feature in PowerPoint. It's super helpful when it comes to making differentiated presentations. So even though it might be the same content to different stakeholders, they can all look different, which is helpful on my end because then I'm not doing the same thing over and over again.
And I don't have an eye for design, so often what it generates looks better than anything I could come up with. So makes me look good easily.
So with ninth grade English, I imagine students were typing up writings. You had mentioned using Soundtrap. How did you incorporate that into what you were doing?
Yeah, so for Soundtrap, I used it a couple of different ways, but I think by the end, what I was doing is I would have students read a play called Fences by August Wilson. And then that play it's very historic. It sort of takes place in 1950s Pittsburgh and connects to a lot of the elements of the African-American experience in America, sort of leading up to the 50s. And so what I would have students do is think a little bit about the play is really concerned with injustices and how that will impact a person in the future, right? They're sort of the main character is sort of looking in retrospect and thinking about the opportunities he did not have because of his race, and that sort of impacts his relationships in the present. And so what I had students do is think about present day's denials of opportunities. What are things that maybe people are being denied today? I would have them research that occasionally using Newzella and other sources. Newzella was helpful for students, especially for differentiation, because it sort of lets you level articles to different reading levels. And then once students had done that research, I would have them do a research paper, which never really goes over well with a classroom when you introduce it. I think just because it sounds so daunting. But eventually I switched from having them write that full research paper to instead doing a research podcast, which both, I think, generated a lot more enthusiasm in them. There's a lot more buy-in initially. And I think the skills that they learned were skills that they weren't really learning in any other classes. Both, I think, the sort of speaking element, right? Being able to prepare, like outline a podcast and then actually getting on mic and speaking it, you know, I think really was something they didn't necessarily do in other classes. And then also thinking about how to like incorporate research in a non-written format. Usually you're thinking about, okay, I'm going to drop quotes in there and then I'll have my citations. But then how do you do that when you're talking about something and you can't like include parentheses and say, this is where I got this from. So yeah, it definitely, and that was also something that I had sort of had to figure out. You know, I think I was pretty comfortable with having students write what that needed to look like, but really having to think as a teacher, what does like an audio research project sound like? And how do I know that the students are sort of meeting the standards they need to meet, either in writing or in speaking?
Awesome. So when you were doing this, I imagine this sounds like you started pre-pandemic and it's something that you carried over. How much of a learning curve was it for the students when it came to the kind of technology? Because I don't imagine that the Chromebook microphones are the best in the world. So did they have other tools that they were using at the same time, or were they doing the best they could with the Chromebook microphones?
For the most part, doing the best they could. We would use the Chromebook microphones. Students would also record the audio sometimes on their phones. And then one other tool is that a lot of students would have headphones, right, whether they're AirPods or just like corded headphones that have a microphone built in that usually was a little bit better than whatever the Chromebook microphone was. And so we would record it on there, which I think students, they were okay with. Obviously, we would listen to some sample podcasts and you hear those and the audio is very good. But they were okay just sort of knowing the sort of limitations of the tools that we had. But I also, we did talk a lot about the best ways to make sure that the audio you were getting was good, even to the point of having some students, they would go home because they didn't necessarily have a quiet space to record. They would just kind of put a blanket over their like whole cells and then record in there. And even we were sort of talking about that and how that like can result in audio that's much better than just having a bunch of noises in the background. It does help. Yeah. So on the whole, we were able to use the technology, and students have so much, you know what I mean? They have phones, they have headphones, they have things they can definitely use. We're living in a culture now where like, we have a lot of different ways to record audio and video, and we were really able to take advantage of some of those tools in the project.
Awesome. You were teaching in New York City, in one of the boroughs, during the beginnings of COVID and throughout most of COVID. Here in Springfield, we know what that was like for our students. What kind of experience did you have teaching, and what kind of experience did your students have? And I'm wondering if it's any different than it would be for here in Massachusetts, since New York and Mass are different states.
Yeah, it sort of happened in, I guess, the sort of 3 years. So like obviously March 2020, we shut down and we're doing remote learning through the end of the year. And my school made the decision to do it entirely asynchronously. So I was posting work and hosting office hours, but there wasn't any set time for students to join a Zoom call. And that obviously it didn't work for many students. Many students felt frustrated or confused. There were, of course, some students who I think did pretty well, a couple who thrived, you know, who I think were a little bit more comfortable kind of working on their own and going at their own pace. But, and then obviously, I think as a teacher, in retrospect, my expectations were lower for, I think, good reasons, right? The students were in a kind of situation unlike any other before. And I, too, you know, was having to figure out, okay, how can I still get the students to learn something through all of this? The next year, so this would be fall 2020 to spring 2021, it was a little bit off and on. We did have in-person learning, but I would say students could opt in to in-person or they could do fully remote. And so I had a small number of students, it was about 5 or 6 over the course of the year, who would come in person and I would work with them. But then all of the other students I was teaching remotely. And then I was doing live Zoom classes, which, you know, I think you try different techniques, you try breakout rooms. I think participation is much harder when the students are virtual, even if you're requiring cameras to be on and requiring students to unmute and speak up. It's much harder to sort of like enforce those things, obviously, and get students to kind of really be a part of the class. And then there are also some situations students may be learning in a crowded environment. They often had siblings who are also doing their own school in the background. So we faced, I think, what are probably a lot of similar challenges. And then the last year, I also taught in the fall of 2021. That was just an issue because all the students were back in school, but students would often be out because they tested positive for COVID and would miss 2 weeks. They would be quarantining. And that actually was probably the most challenging because I would have students in such like divergent situations. It was hard to manage the students who were out for 2 weeks who I wasn't going to see versus the students who I had in front of me, keeping them on pace. That was, I think, definitely a trial.
Hey everyone, it's Mike jumping in here for just a quick little bumper. If you like what you've heard so far, make sure you never miss a show by clicking on the subscribe button now in your favorite podcast platform. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you. So thank you again for your support. Now back to this interview. So if I'm hearing this right, during the 2020-2021 school year, you had students
throughout the entire year who were with you, but you also had a large group of students who were not. And then was that for the entire year, or did that start halfway through? Because I know here in Springfield, it was spring of 2021 where we went to concurrent learning, which is what you were talking about with doing the Zoom live with students in front of you.
Yeah, it started, I think there was maybe a week or two in the beginning of the school year where all students were remote just to sort of like get ourselves set up first. But then after those 2 weeks, we did have those that small group of students in person. And then there was, I think it was probably about a month and a half, maybe 2 months in the middle of the school year. I think it was probably February and March, something like that, where we all were teaching and learning from home. That was sort of the 2 months, I think, when there was a spike and they just closed the schools for that time.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were back, I think, probably about beginning of April for the rest of the school year.
And that was with the five or six in person, and then everybody else was remote.
Yep.
I know that teaching high school is not like elementary, which is where my experience is, where I had the same students all day long. Did you have like rotating groups in your classroom that would come in, or like how was that set up, I guess? Because I can see it for elementary. I have a harder time with the upper grades since I never taught it that way.
Yeah, we were lucky to have two very good schedulers, the people sort of setting up the schedule, because it was wildly complex. It's sort of like the worst logic puzzle you'll ever encounter. I would have sort of like in-person sections and then remote sections. And so I would sort of like, I would kind of get to school, maybe I'd have a prep period in the morning. Then I would teach a 45-minute Zoom class. Then I would go down and work with a small group of in-person students for about 45 minutes. Then maybe lunch, and then another Zoom class. After that, another live session. And then the only thing, or the good thing about the setup is that those in-person student groups, they were tied to one of the Zoom classes. So if we had to, like we did, teach from home for a while, if they had to learn remotely, they would very easily fold back into that class. We were doing the same content. They had obviously the same teachers, so there was no interruption, at least in that regard.
It's funny to me, I guess, because anytime I think of like schools in New York City, knowing that it's one of the most populated states and cities in the entire world, I always think of like large schools and lots of students. But one of the things that you said early on was that you were a new school that was smaller. So what kind of mission did your school have when you first started?
Yeah, so we were an early college high school. I think the first one was called P-Tech. That's in Brooklyn in New York. And so we were sort of modeled on their model. And what it is you partner with a community college. So we were in Queens, and we were partnered with LaGuardia Community College, which was about, let's say, a 15-minute walk from us. And students could stay basically at our school for 6 years. And at the end of those 6 years, they would have both a high school diploma, but then also an associate's degree from LaGuardia. And this was entirely free. It was paid for by the city. And we focused specifically on engineering programs. So students could get an associate's in electrical engineering, or I believe it was mechanical engineering, or something similar to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did, students took engineering all four of the high school years. We had a very popular robotics team that was kind of like the equivalent of our football team. You know, that's the thing that everybody would wear shirts for on game day or match days. And so, yeah, definitely kind of a STEM focused school.
That's cool. That strategy and philosophy is something that I know has really cropped up in the last 10 years, is the idea of high school to community college. Now, did you specifically just stay with ninth grade, or did you work with other grades too?
I taught ninth grade the whole time, which was good. I really like ninth graders. There's a certain, it's just such an interesting transition point. And you sort of see this as you're teaching them throughout the year. They come in as eighth graders, or eighth graders in a new place, because they're like a little bit kind of frightened and a little bit uncertain. And then over the course of the year, you see them become 10th graders. And by that point, you're ready to like, all right, you go on to 10th grade. I'm ready to get this new group. But it is a really fun moment, because you do see a lot of growth in that time. And you really start to see students' personalities develop in a distinct way.
Mm-hmm. So in your time, because you said you were there for about 6 years, that would mean that you would have had your first group of ninth graders get their associate's degree, right? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did you see a lot of them go into trades, or did they go off to other colleges with their associates, or like, how did it work for those students that you started with? Because I imagine that's probably one of the groups that you remember the best.
Yeah. So it actually varied. And that was something that, because when I started teaching at the school, I think my ninth graders were only the third class we'd had. So we hadn't had anybody complete the associate's program. We hadn't had anybody even complete the first 4 years of high school. So it was sort of a big question. And I think, and this is probably true of any high school graduating class, it's sort of like the variance of what students go on to do. I would say typically we'd have 50 to 60%. And these statistics might be a little bit out of date, would go on to do the associate's program. And there'd always be some drop off there. Students would decide they didn't want to do engineering and would continue at the community college and get an associate's in something else. So we definitely saw some students graduate there. And we did have, I know some students would go on to work for one of the utility companies in the city, Con Edison, because we were actually partnered with them and occasionally would have students doing internships there. And they were sort of one of the partners in the founding of the school. Other students would take the four-year high school diploma and then go on to a four-year school or go on to a different community college that was closer to home or had a program they were more interested in. And then some other students, a smaller percentage, would graduate with a four-year degree and then just go right into the workforce. Yeah, so it would end up being a variance, I would say. Definitely more of an interest in STEM fields. I know I still get, from those first couple classes, I'll sometimes get like LinkedIn, requests, and they're often doing either something engineering related or computer science related, or I know there's some students who are very active with the robotics team who are definitely still doing things related to that. Yeah, so it's been super interesting to see kind of what they've gone off to do.
Yeah, I know from teaching fifth grade, it takes a lot longer for me to see that. And so it's been interesting the last few years to see students who, like, I would introduce computer science concepts like coding to then move on and go into a field or go to a college to learn more and develop those skills, which is kind of really cool to see. And so for me, it takes a lot longer to see that. I think I've got maybe two more classes that will be graduating before I will not have taught any students in the district, which is kind of interesting to think about too. So,
yeah, and it's a great feeling when you sort of see like, oh yeah, I worked with this student. This is something I introduced them to and they are pursuing Yeah,
absolutely. So that takes us to almost to today. Your family moved from Queens and Brooklyn and the boroughs down in New York to Western Massachusetts. One, that's a big move, at least in my mind, it probably isn't. But so when you moved, why did you focus on finding a job that is not teaching, but related to education and technology?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I was looking for, I think when I was first looking for jobs up here, I definitely was keeping some teaching jobs on my radar. But I do think one of the things I was looking for was a little bit of a new challenge at the school I was teaching at. I had taught the same grade for a long time and had sort of really, I kind of nailed down that curriculum and sort of how I would approach the school year. And it's getting to the point where it was a little bit routine. And with the exception of the pandemic that was in the middle of it. And so I knew I sort of wanted something that was different. I wanted something that would help me grow maybe in like a different way, and whether that looked like teaching a different grade, a different, not a different content area, but like a different sort of focus for the course in English, or working for, say, like a school district or an ed tech company or something that would kind of introduce me to a different side of education. And I think one of the things I had always enjoyed while I was teaching, I was also leading the sort of tech team at the school and working a lot with teachers on both like implementing technology, sort of like on the hardware side, making sure teachers knew how to access everything and what we had. Mm-hmm. Then also on the curriculum side, sort of thinking about, okay, how can I integrate this into my curriculum? And so I think my sort of ideal was something that combined those things, right, would still help me keep maybe a foot in the classroom and working with teachers, in addition to thinking a little bit more big picture about how technology is used in schools, why it's used, and what the sort of best way to get it actually like authentically used in classrooms in ways that improves learning. Yeah, which I think is when I sort of saw this position, I was like, oh, wow, this I think connects to a lot of the things that I have been thinking about and have been working on in my education career.
That's awesome, because sometimes when you're teaching, like, we always tend to think of like, oh, the path forward if I want to grow in my career is, well, I need to become a building leader. And then from a building leader, I need to become like a subject matter leader, like an ILS here in Springfield. And then from there, maybe I'll become an AP and then a principal and then director of something and then superintendent down the line. Like, if you're thinking about career growth. So it's very cool to hear you talk about how, because of this one thing you were doing in the classroom, that kind of led you to, hey, I kind of want to focus on this, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. And I think one of the things I've always appreciated about technology and education is that it often goes hand in hand with more transformative, like, curriculum design and teaching practices. I think the teachers who are often very excited about using technology are also very excited about maybe trying new lesson formats or thinking about different ways that classrooms can be structured, which is also something I've been interested in. And so I think thinking about those two things together is definitely something I'm interested in continuing to think about and has sort of led me to here at Springfield.
Mm-hmm. So here in Springfield, what are your focuses? Because I know, for those who don't know, our department is 4 people total, or 5, I guess, now with the director of computer science.
Yeah.
So we all have different roles that we play. So what is the role that you play?
Yeah. So it's some days I feel like I wear many different hats and play many different roles. I would say my main focus is supporting teachers in Springfield with Schoology, our learning management system, with Performance Matters, one of our assessment platforms, and Power Teacher Pro, the sort of grade book that's attached to Power School. And that looks like running trainings for teachers. It looks like hosting office hours for teachers, answering tickets and emails for teachers who have questions. So that's a big chunk of the work. I also spend some time researching different platforms to potentially bring into the district. In addition to supporting the occasional project that comes up, we're doing some research into standards-based grading and the best ways we can support that with the technology we already have and possibly new technology in the district. In addition to, I also coordinate meetings for the technology coordinators at the school, in addition to a couple other teams and sort of meetings that I set up and run.
Awesome. So with what you're doing, what are some things that you're looking forward to seeing happen? Any sort of changes, or maybe it's even with the standardized grades, hopefully that it makes that would make it easier on our end.
Yes, but it definitely would.
So what are some things that you're looking forward to seeing implemented?
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of exciting ideas and potential with the Portrait of a Graduate strategic plan, and I know the cohort schools are trying a lot of these things. So definitely, I think what it looks like to truly use standards-based grading will, I think, definitely be a super interesting thing, both to see happen in the district and support. I think similarly about, I think, moving some of the curriculum in a little bit more of a project-based direction. I know that there have been conversations about that, and that was something I was trying to move towards in my own teaching practice. And so I think seeing the district or schools move in that direction, in addition to thinking about, okay, how can some of the technology we have really support that? And one of some of the ways to make sure teachers are able to leverage that technology in thinking about possibly redesigning their curriculum. Yeah, so I think it is, that's what I was sort of saying, that place where technology and curriculum meet and how one can sort of help you redesign the other. There's sort of like it's like kind of a back and forth, right? Oh, here's this new technology I have. How can I use it within my curriculum? Oh, now I want to change my curriculum. Is there any technology I can use sort of helped me in that shift. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing some of those transformations, some of those evolutions.
Yeah, the standards-based grading is something that we've been kind of working on in the background for many years now. So it's nice to see that we're starting to actually move forward. And we have at least one school by the end of this year, which will be using standards-based grades, which is exciting. So before we run out of time, because we're going to run out of time, even though we both are here in this department,
yeah,
working together, and time is whatever we want it to be. One of the things that really struck me during the beginning of COVID was when I read the digital learning playbook, the very first chapter is all about self-care and taking care of yourself. And as teachers, on the whole, we're not very good at that. And many of us are still struggle with it even now. So what are some ways that you're taking care of yourself that could be an encouragement to others?
Yeah. So I think one of my biggest things, or the thing that I think helps me feel the best, you know, is I love to run. That's something that I try to do. I try to do it every day. I would say I'm not always successful at doing it every day. But it is definitely something that I think both, obviously it's exercise, makes me feel healthy, makes me feel good, but it also can be a little bit meditative because it is a moment where you sort of have to, right, if you're sitting at a computer or you're teaching all day, it is a nice break because it's just something that you're using your body in a different way and you don't really have to like think, use the sort of same brain muscles that you are sort of throughout the day. And so that's a sort of helpful break. I would often do that, especially when I was teaching. I would get home, go for a run immediately. And that felt sort of like almost like kind of a reset. I was able to sort of let go of a lot of the things that happened during the day and sort of be more present at home at night.
Awesome. So as a runner, do you just run for yourself or have you entered any races? Have you thought about marathons?
Yeah, I've done half marathons. I haven't done one in the past couple of years. I think probably actually not since the pandemic. Obviously, during the pandemic, I was kind of staying away from them and I just haven't signed up yet because the training can be a little bit daunting, especially with a move and a new job. And then my wife and I are expecting. So I think there's a lot of it's hard to sign up for a race, not quite knowing what the immediate future is going to hold in that regard. But it's definitely something that I want to get back into because it's such a great feeling to do something like a half marathon. I mean, the great feeling really comes at the end when you finish it, that sort of sense of accomplishment and like kind of thrill, really. But it is definitely something that I think is both helpful in terms of having a good training plan and then also just for the kind of fun and social aspect of it.
Awesome. Well, Matt, thank you for your time. For those who want to get a hold of Matt, you know how to here in the district because we're always available to answer your questions, except for when we're doing things like this, talking together for a podcast episode. So thanks for taking some time out of your day.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. It was fun.
Thanks, Matt, again for taking time, sitting down with me and chatting. This was one of our longer conversations that we've had on the podcast recently, so hopefully you all got a lot out of it. You can hear all the great things that Matt is doing. I just want to thank all of you listeners today. If you enjoyed this episode of the SBS Digital Learning Hour, we'd love for your support of the podcast. Please share it with others, post about it on social media, leave a rating and review. Head over to iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you happen to listen to us. Make sure you're subscribed there. That's where you can leave us your rating, of course, your review. And if you do this on iTunes in particular, it really helps us move up and get the word out on how awesome Springfield teachers are. I am Mike Thomas, the Bearded Tech Ed Guy, and this is the SBS Digital Learning Hour.